Hello again and welcome to Wrestling Memories on Pioneer 90.1 FM KSRQ. You can check us out live and in the moment beyond the FM dial at www.radionorthland.org and tune in. That's an app you can pick up for your smartphone. Many different ways you can listen to us live, but you can also go to our website to listen to our archives. We've got over 6 years of classic Wrestling Memories episodes at radionorthland.org. That'll link you up to our SoundCloud page. And man, you want to talk about a cavalcade of wrestling legends, we have them in the Wrestling Memories Archives. Glenn Brockett with you this week, and my, do I have a great guest, a main event, if you will. This gentleman is well-known up here in AWA country in the late 1980s. He was Law and Order in Order. He wrestled as the Trooper, and of course, he moved on to put on the mask and gain worldwide fame as the Patriot. He was an All-American football player. He's had his ups, he's had his downs, but the thing is, he's here to tell his story, and we're going to share some of his story today in the time that he has been so graciously allowing us to chat with him about pro wrestling, breaking in, his time in the AWA as the Trooper. It's just such an honor and just an ultimate privilege of mine to welcome a guy that I'm a true fan of growing up watching on the AWA and, of course, on the Global Wrestling Network, Wrestling Federation. We're talking about Del Wilkes, the Patriot, up here in AWA country, brother. We still remember you as the Trooper. Thank you so much for coming on the program today.
Well, thank you for having me, Glenn. I appreciate it very much. And that AWA country is still very dear to me. That was in the infancy of my career, and I spent some time up there, lived up there for a while. So that area, those people, those memories are just very dear to me and very fond.
And we're going to talk about some of those memories. But as of our recording today, Del, right now here, it is April 18th, 2018. News kind of came across the wire this morning over about the passing of Bruno Sammartino. Although he gained great fame in the 60s and 70s, when you hear the name Bruno Sammartino, that definitely still sends ripples across the wrestling business. And news of his passing just came across the wire as we turned on our mics today.
Yeah, that's. I was saddened to hear that. Excuse me. I met Bruno on several occasions, and just a class guy, a true gentleman, and obviously an iconic figure in the wrestling industry. And you know, when you look at how important he was to pro wrestling, and again, you know, when he was working, things were territorial in that Vince McMahon Sr. company that he worked for. How important Bruno was to wrestling in the Northeast, but not only to the business itself, but to the fans. I mean, those people loved Bruno. Those people believed in Bruno. And to the Italians and the Italian-Americans, Bruno was just a hero to them and many others. But, man, what a larger-than-life figure. Hulk Hogan-like before Hogan ever came along.
Oh, absolutely. And when you look back at just Bruno's impressive run, for him to, Vince McMahon Sr. to be able to put on the title and have it on for so long, those long title reigns of Bruno's were definitely something that created great box office and a wonderful fan following up there in the Northeast. And boy, what an impact when you talk about even like our big arenas like Madison Square Garden with all the pomp and the splendor and the circumstances through the years. You mentioned Bruno Sammartino's name in Madison Square Garden. You're going to get that same type of pop, if not more. Just is a testament to how larger than life he was and what a shadow he casted over professional wrestling.
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, I went back this morning when I heard of Bruno's passing and just watched again his Hall of Fame, WWE Hall of Fame acceptance speech. And he hit the nail right on the head that today there are bigger, more impressive arenas all over the world, but there's probably none that's as iconic and has the name recognition as Madison Square Garden. And to think that on 187 different occasions with him headlining the card, they sold out Madison Square Garden, that speaks a lot to Bruno and his popularity and his influence on the business.
And beyond just his popularity, you want to talk about a guy that was dedicated to physical fitness and conditioning, too. And I know that was a big testament to your life and career, both in on the gridiron and professional wrestling, was training and managing to keep your body professional wrestling shape, not only just in peak physical condition, but there's a different kind of animal to having a pro wrestling type of a fit.
Yeah, it is. It's funny you mentioned that. I remember when I was first breaking into the business here in Columbia, South Carolina, I was going to a school that was owned and operated by the fabulous Mullah Lillian Ellison, and I thought I was equipped for anything. I had just come out of a very successful college football career at the University of South Carolina, a brief two-year stint in the NFL, and I thought, man, I'm a football player. I'm a tough guy. I can handle anything, and there's nothing that's been tougher than training and preparation for football practice or football seasons, two-a-days and things like that. And then I got into the ring and started taking bumps, and I realized while I may be in football shape, I had no clue what I was in for once I got inside a ring and started getting bumped around that ring. So, yes, you better believe it. It takes a different kind of conditioning to be able to excel once you're in that ring.
You know, you bring up Lillian Ellison, the fabulous Mullah, and of course she was so instrumental in your career, getting you off and training you and seeing you through those early days and working on some of Mullah's shows. And, you know, it has been kind of a delicate touch, hot button sort of issue lately about Lillian in regards, of course, to the controversy that happened with the WWE over the female battle royal that was in WrestleMania here this past year. But I'm instead of me just at throwing all kinds of different type of questions, I really want to have you tell me your experiences of working with Lillian and how she was so integral into your career and what you remember with working with the fabulous Mullah, because a lot of people say a lot of things, but I want to hear it from you because she was such a part of your life early on in your training and development that I really want to get the straight scoop from your perspective about working with and being trained by Lillian. And, you know, man, this was a big part of your life. This was how you got into the business.
Absolutely. I obviously growing up here in Columbia, South Carolina, that's Lillian's hometown as well. It's where she was born and raised. And growing up, not only a football fan, but a huge wrestling fan. I know who Lillian was long before I ever decided to go to her school and train there. It was sort of a process of elimination for me on choosing her school. It was local. It was convenient. And compared to other schools that I've looked at, it was a little bit more affordable. And so that made it pretty easy for me. I called her up. We met. You know, she told me what to expect going through the school. I told her what my hopes were, what my dreams were. And off we went. And while it was a school that was really geared more for women, there have been so many women that have gone through Lillian's facility and gone on to have great careers and make great names for themselves. I've really been the only guy that's ever gone through there to have any type of success. So it was really more geared for the women, but still, she had such a mind full of knowledge and experience that she could pass on to me. And while she very seldom actually got into the ring with me while we were training, there were guys there that worked for her who were professional wrestlers that did that part of it. I didn't expect a 60-year-old lady to get in the ring with me and show me how to take bumps, but she instructed those guys, and she also helped me with the psychology of it, just the presentation of yourself, how to handle yourself, how to conduct yourself as a professional wrestler. And I loved her. She was a part of my life up until the day she died. Matter of fact, just not even a week before she went into the hospital to have this old shoulder surgery, from which she never recovered, never went home. She called me, and I spent probably an hour on the phone with her and Mae Young and just talking and having a good time and reminiscing. And I didn't always agree with Lillian while I was going through her school on things that she did, on ideas, on payouts, things like that. It seemed most of our disagreements were over money, but I think that's pretty common with anybody you've ever worked for in the business. Especially in the early part of your career, if you're not working with a major company, maybe you do have some issues and disagreements over payout and money and things like that, but I never found any of it to be malicious, to be anything that I ever held a grudge about. We were always able to work through our differences and just keep moving on and conduct business. And I know so many of the women that have gone through Lillian's school and broke into business under Lillian, trained under her, And not all of those, you know, or most of those at some point in time had disagreements with Lillian. That's just a part of the business. It's a part of the world that we worked in and existed in. But from those disagreements over payouts or over booking dates or lack of booking dates, for that to morph into the calls that this woman was a racist, a bigot, a pimp, a drug peddler, they're outrageous. They're lies. And I find it to be a sorry state of affairs in the world that we live in today that those kind of lies, those kind of outrageous rumors can grow into something so big, so fast, that would cause the WWE, because of pressure from a corporate sponsor, to remove her name from that battle royal. You know, we saw, Glenn, we saw a lot of women that are big-time players in the world of professional wrestling when it was first announced that it would be the Lillian Ellison Ladies Battle Royal. We saw them on WWE just talking about how proud they were to participate in an event that had her name on it. What an iconic figure she was to them as they were growing up in the wrestling world and as young girls watching at home on TV. What an inspiration she was, what motivation she provided. And then you take that in a short, basically 72 hours later, she's been called a racist, a bigot, a pimp, a drug dealer. It was just sickening, and it was just so disheartening and so sad to see that happen. So I thank you for asking me and giving me an opportunity to give you my feelings and my thoughts and my experiences with Lillian. She wasn't a perfect lady, and guess what? I wasn't a perfect student, and I wasn't a perfect guy. I never have been. But from being an imperfect individual like we all are, to being, being end up called the things that she was called while this was going on, and still to this day, it's just, it's really just disgusting.
And I appreciate you being able to want to share with me about and your honesty towards Lillian, because, you know, a lot of stuff just gets bantied about. And, you know, we talked about, you know, getting trained with Moolah. You know, I hear lots of stories about the place where Moolah trained. It's kind of almost like the southern version of the Hart House. Can you talk about the accommodations that you were training at Moolah's place?
Well, Moolah had her house there, which was a nice home. It'd been added on to, you know, many times. It was sort of pieced together, but it turned out to be a very nice home. And it overlooked a pond that Lillian had on her land there. And around that pond, or that little lake, were several little cottages or little houses that she had built. And those were where the girls lived, the ladies lived, that were going through Moolah school. And they paid their money to go through the school to get trained by Lillian. Lillian would also book them on shows all over the country, all over the world. But they also lived in those little cottages. And, of course, Lillian provided the electricity, the water, and things of that nature. And the girls, you know, paid rent for those things as well. But it was a pretty neat setup there to, you know, have everything sort of self-contained right there on about, I guess, 10 acres or so with her home, the pond, and the several houses that she had there for the girls to live in. And then she had sort of a barn-like structure. Literally right out her back door. You could go out her back door and not take 10 steps, and you could walk into this building, and there was the ring. And they're not a very big building. The ring sort of fit pretty tightly in this barn-like structure, but you had enough room to get in there and work and do the things you needed to do and take bumps. And it wasn't air-conditioned. It didn't have heat in it, so it was very, very hot during the summer and very cold in the winter. But we were able to make, you know, the necessary thing, changes that we had to, you know, bundle up or take some clothes off based on the temperature outside and inside. But it was a pretty neat setup. It was all right there, just all together.
Yeah, it's kind of like when I think about that, too, I also think about the old film of the AWA when Vern had his training camp and some of the guys that had the train in the barn. You've heard tales about, you know, out of that training camp as well. Imagine, you know, you talk about South Carolina, the Carolinas and how what Carolina cold was. Could you imagine being up there like the guys like, you know, Ken Patera and Flair and those guys running around in that barn back in those sub-zero days of winter?
Oh, absolutely. And to that other extreme would be a Columbia, South Carolina summer. I've been all over the world, and believe me, it's hot during the summer most places you go. But Columbia, South Carolina has a unique hotness about it, very high humidity. Very seldom do you get any kind of wind or breeze. So while those guys, I'm sure, under those conditions for Vern were dying during those winters, but you climb into Mueller's Ring during the middle of July, and it was brutal. I mean, it was hot.
Oh, man. And I want to talk, today, as we talk, of course, we just mentioned at the beginning of the show about the passing of Bruno. Now, today I was looking online, and I don't know if this is completely accurate, but I saw a posting on one of the Mid-Atlantic sites that it's been 16 years already since we lost a gentleman that you want to talk about people that had roles in kind of along your path to pro wrestling and educating yourself in the business. The name Wahoo McDaniel definitely comes to mind, and apparently it was 16 years ago that we lost Wahoo. So now we're going to have both Bruno and Wahoo now as we remember this date in history.
I tell you, it's hard to believe that Wahoo's been dead that long, and truly, one of the dearest friends I ever had. It's funny you mentioned that, but our connection, our friendship, Wahoo and I, it grew as a result of Mula. Wahoo was working for Vern and had an apartment up in Minneapolis. He still had his permanent home in Charlotte. And this was when I was going through Mula school. And Mula would run shows around South Carolina, small shows in high school gyms or, fairgrounds and things like that. And Wahoo was home for several weeks in Charlotte. So Lillian had booked him on one of her shows. And so Wahoo came in and worked, and that was the first time I met Wahoo. And of course, again, just like with Mula, I knew all about Wahoo and was a huge Wahoo fan as a kid watching wrestling and a young man watching wrestling. And we hit it off immediately. And it was just an instant connection, an instant chemistry that we had. And I think that background of football had a lot to do with it. We come from the same kind of background as far as athletics were concerned. He was an All-American at Oklahoma. I was an All-American at the University of South Carolina. My NFL career came nowhere close to what Wahoo's was. But we just hit it off, and he just took a liking to me. And literally, he was responsible for getting me up to Minneapolis to work for Vern. He was the guy that went to Vern and Greg and said, "Hey, I met a guy down in the Carolinas named Bill Wilkes. Good looking kid, athletic guy, played football at the University of South Carolina, trying to break into the business." So Wahoo opened that door for me and others. And he literally took me under his arm and under his wing, I should say, and just mentored me in the business. And man, I will always, always be grateful for what Wahoo meant to me personally, to my career, and just as a friend, just an unbelievably good man.
So you were able to kind of, at this formative stage in your developing stage of your career, you were able to kind of sit under the learning tree, not only of Mula, but now were you able to do some traveling with Wahoo while he was kind of, splitting time between the Carolinas and the AWA before you ended up making that push up? You talk about you guys hit it off, but did you guys actually get into do some spot shows together? Did you guys get in the car and do some traveling at that time? Or what was the sort of relationship that was blossoming for you two as far as professional and personal?
No, that's exactly what we did. When I said he took me under his wing, that's exactly what we did. And he put me in his Bronco, and he had one of those OJ type Broncos and the Ford Broncos. And he put me in that thing along with Zach, who was his youngest son. And Wahoo was going through, he was separated from Linda, who he was married to at the time. And so me and Zach probably wouldn't have been 18 months at that point in time, maybe 2 years old. But me and him and Zach, man, we hit the road. And Wahoo made sure that wherever Wahoo got booked, Dell got booked. And I traveled with him and spent countless hours and thousands of miles on the road with him and was able to pick his brain. And not only wrestling, but football. Just life in general, and just to be around him. And he was a unique character. He truly was a character. There was a soft heart in there, especially for guys like myself that were trying to break into the business. He was very good to people that were trying to break into the business. And and trying to learn their way and learn the ropes. But there was also a gruff exterior about Wahoo that if you didn't know him, you would think, man, this guy is just, you know, wow. He could have an explosive temper. He could be volatile. He was a man's man. He drank hard. He worked hard. He partied hard. He fished hard. He golfed hard. He did it all wide open. And I mean, he held nothing back. But at his core, he was a genuine good man.
I had a chance. It was at my first pro wrestling show I went to as a kid. It was well over 30 years ago now. It was an AWA house show up to where I live up in northwestern Minnesota, and Wahoo was on the card. And he was one of the first pro wrestlers that I actually kind of, you know, I was only probably about a sixth grader in school. I went up, mounted up the courage to ask for him for his autograph, and, you know, he obliged, and we sat around, and, you know, I was just a young kid, and we were talking football. Of course, I was always watching, you know, NFL films and stuff, and, you know, he had just been on an NFL program on HBO inside the NFL, so I mentioned that, and we ended up having this nice little conversation, and he didn't make me feel like I was just this little kid that was wasting his time. So it really kind of felt like this couple of minutes that felt like it was hours, just to be able to, you know, be this kid to talk to one of my heroes at the time. And that was something I would never forget, and kind of kept me going and watching more wrestling even at that age.
Yeah. He was good about that. He taught me a lot about interaction with fans and how to treat fans. And just a quick little story. We were working a little spot show somewhere up in North Carolina one night. And it's about an hour before the show starts. And I've got my pictures out on the table. And I've got I'm out there selling pictures and talking to the fans. And, you know, just spending time with people that came up, whether they wanted a picture or not. And once the show started and we were all back in the dressing room, he pulled me aside and he said, "Hey, just let me give you a little advice." He said, "I know you want to sell some pictures and pick up a few extra bucks and you want to interact with the fans." And he said, "That's all good and fine." He said, "But when they see you for the first time," he said, "it really needs to be when you're coming through that curtain." And he said, "That's the first time that night they've seen you. They've laid eyes on you." And he said, "You're sort of larger than life to them." He said, "If you have spent an hour prior to the show talking to them and telling them about your wife and what your kid's doing in preschool and about your mom and your daddy and your football career," he said, "they feel like they know you." And he said, "You're really not that big a deal when you walk through that curtain. You're sort of just another guy." He said, "But you want them to think you're something a little special." And he said, "So maybe spend a little less time out there hawking pictures." And I just found it to be invaluable advice. I thought it was just spot on.
Yeah, and what great pearls of wisdom among many that you had received, with Wahoo. And we talked about the AWA and how Wahoo was able to open doors for you to make your way up to Minnesota. And, we touched a little bit about, differences in climate, differences in a whole bunch of things. Let's talk about getting into the American Wrestling Association. Now, what was you mentioned Wahoo, but I want to talk about getting in and your dealings with both Vern and Greg at the time, and at that place in time with the AWA, who had seen some of its years, glory years kind of start to pass, in the midst of the territories starting to really be in its last legs with McMahon with his WWF expansion. But could you tell me about heading up over to Minnesota and encountering the Gagnas, father and son of Vern and Greg? Now, that's quite a lot of notoriety going in with Vern, being the head of the promotion and all.
Yeah, like I did with Wahoo and Moolah, believe me, I was a big wrestling fan as a kid. And when my mom would go grocery shopping on Fridays, I would sit at the foot of that magazine rack in the grocery store, and I'd look through every wrestling magazine there was. So I was very well aware of Vern Gagne and just how big he was and how important he was to the wrestling industry. And my first time up there, a buddy of mine that graduated from the Citadel, military college in Charleston, South Carolina, we were breaking into the business together. And this was the meeting, the arrangement that Wahoo had set up for us. So we drive up, we pack basically all our earthly belongings into a 1985 Cutlass, and we head up to Minneapolis. And we get there in the wintertime, and of course, that's just in and of itself a rude awakening. And we met Vern, we met Greg. I talked with both of them on the phone quite a bit prior to getting there. And it had changed. It wasn't what it once was. The AWA wasn't. The territories were really dying out then. And at one time, that was maybe the largest and most productive and most successful, or one of the most successful territories there was. I mean, just a who's who of pro wrestlers came through that territory and worked for Vern, but it wasn't that way then. They were struggling. Fortunately, they had the ESPN contract, and their show was on the air 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 5 o'clock. So that was a good thing. It exposed me to a nationwide and maybe even a worldwide audience. I don't know the scope of the ESPN back that long ago, 30 years ago, but we know it was certainly nationwide. And so I just went in as Del Wilkes. And, you know, they had told me they felt like I could have a good career in that business. And some of the things they thought about doing with me down the road, I needed to gain more experience. And they worked with me on promos and interviews. And I spent countless hours in the ring with Brad Ringens and, of course, with Greg as well, just trying to help me get better, sort of hone my skills. But they took a break later that year. Businesses was bad. They didn't have anything booked. It was primarily a TV company. They had enough shows in the can that they could, you know, continue to provide ESPN with matches. And so we took about 6 or 7 weeks off and came back to South Carolina, my buddy and I did. And they called me back up about 7 weeks later and wanted me to come back up. They had some shows lined up and booked in the Dakotas and Wisconsin and Minnesota. But they didn't want my buddy to come. They just didn't think that he really had much of a career ahead of him. But they wanted to do something different with me. And one of the guys that helped train me while working in Moolah School was a full-time deputy sheriff in one of the counties here locally in South Carolina. And he worked Moolah shows basically in his deputy sheriff outfit, and he worked as the super enforcer on these little outlaw shows that Moolah would run. And while I was up in Minneapolis that first go-round, he had sent me a tape of some of his matches and asked me if I would give it to Vern and Greg to see what they thought about it. So I passed it on to him, left it with him, didn't think anything else about it, came home for those 6 or 7 weeks. They called me back and said, "Hey, man, we're ready to run some shows and do some business. Come on back, but we've got an idea. Your buddy that you gave us the tape of, the cop, we really don't see anything there. He needs to continue to keep his full-time job and enforce the law enforcement officer, but we like the gimmick. We like the character. So we've got an idea called the Trooper. When you get up here, we'll lay it out to you and just sit down with you and present the whole thing to you." So they came up with that idea. So my second trip back up to Minneapolis, that's when we started doing the Trooper character and the Trooper gimmick. And that, again, helped open some doors for me and expose me to, again, that nationwide audience on ESPN. They put me in some matches with Zbyszko, who was their champ at the time. And that did wonders for me. Even though the company, you know, was on the verge of folding up, and they eventually did, man, it did tremendous things for me and opened other doors for me.
You know, when you talk about the AWA and when you came in with the Trooper gimmick, yeah, I remember a lot of those earlier matches when you were working in singles competition exclusive, and you ended up, you were right in with the main event scene. What was it like to kind of work with another veteran like Larry Zbyszko, who kind of came at it with his own sort of psychology? With Larry, it was a lot of, more about kind of getting into the and under the skin of the wrestling fan without really, you know, for the first few minutes touching actual hands. It was a different sort of thing that kind of harkened back to the old days of building anticipation.
And you're right, it did. It was different for me. That was the first time I had really worked with anybody like Larry that did things in that way, you know, that interacted with the audience like that from the ring, that interacted with the fans and you know, would yell at them and scream at them and have dialogue with them. And, you know, long before we would ever touch each other. And it was, you know, time was going by. And in my young, naive mind, I'm thinking, come on, man, let's get going here. We got to do something. We're cheating these people out of getting to see us, you know, wrestle each other. But it was just part of his great in-ring psychology. And I'll tell you, it wasn't just Larry. Even though they were a struggling company at that time and really on life support, they had a lot of young guys in there like myself, but they also had guys coming in for the TV shows. Now, Larry lived up there. He was married to Vern's daughter at the time, but they brought in Sergeant Slaughter. They brought in Ox Baker. They brought in Nikita Koloff. They brought in Johnny Valiant. So they would bring in quite often very seasoned veterans and guys that had very good careers. Maybe they're on the backside of that career now, but still, they've got big-time name recognition, and it gave me an opportunity to work in tag matches with some of these guys, to work against some of these guys, and to learn from them as well. So it was very, very valuable in that sense. And as a matter of fact, something happened to me one night working a show in Jamestown, North Dakota. I get to the building. It's just a spot show. And I see that Harley Race and I are working main event that night. The Trooper, Harley Race. And Greg came and got me. And he said, hey, man, did you see you're working with Harley tonight? And I said, yeah. And immediately I was just so nervous. I was about to blow chow. I thought, man, Harley Race is going to work with me. And I'm just a greenhorn. And Greg said, man, it'll be a great experience for you. He said, just shut your mouth, listen to Harley. He'll call it in a ring. And he said, at the end, you're going to catch a quick one on Harley. And I said, what? He said, yeah, Harley's going to put you over. You'll catch a quick one on him. He said, the ref will raise your hand. You just roll out of the ring and get out of there and let Harley just kick the ropes and raise Kane. And I said, Greg, I said, does Harley know this? Because I thought, you got to be kidding me. I mean, you guys must be pulling something over on Harley. Has Harley agreed to put me over? But it was just a spot show. But at the same time, it meant something to me that Harley Race, Vern Gagne, Greg Gagne thought that I had enough potential and enough of something going good for me that Harley would go out there and just put me over clean, 1, 2, 3, in the middle of the ring. That wasn't TV. The only people that saw it were the people there that night. But still, when you're in my position as a young, up-and-coming guy trying to make it in that business, it was a great boost of confidence for me.
Now, I'll mention it's a couple of guys you also mentioned, you know, and another wrestler we just lost was Johnny Valiant. And, of course, it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, that we lost Ox Baker. Now, these guys not necessarily at that point in AWA were in-ring working wrestling guy. You know, they were more known for what they also brought with, aside from their presence, but what they brought with on the microphone. Now, there's other things that you can't help but glean from those guys, aside from in-ring, when you have two guys that can really have command of the microphone and also do such great work without even getting in through the ropes now at this point in their career.
Oh, absolutely. You know, those guys, Ox and Valiant, those guys were characters. And you learn from them by talking to them. I spent a good bit of time with Ox and talking to him and a couple of times with Valiant, and just how important that character was as well. You know, I was learning that there was more to this business than just getting in the ring and taking a backdrop, clotheslining the guy, suplexing the guy, dropkicking the guy. There's a lot more to it than that. There's also the character that you've got to develop, and you've got to create something that the fans are interested in and the fans want to see, and the fans are willing to take money out of their pocket and drop it down to buy a ticket. So you're exactly right. I learned so much from those guys, and not all of it was what to do in a ring. As a matter of fact, Ox Baker really wasn't known for his ability in the ring. Ox Baker was a character, and characters are just as important as guys that can execute a good arm drag.
This is Wrestling Memories on Pioneer 90.1 FM with my special guest, the Patriot Del Wilkes. We're talking about Del's run in the AWA as the Trooper. And before we get into the AWA Team Challenge Series talk, I want to talk about your foray into tag team wrestling. First, with Paul Diamond and some of the matches that you guys had with Wayne Bloom and Mike Enos. And later, with Paul going to the WWF, you ended up being partnered up with DJ Peterson. Let's talk about working with both Paul and DJ as partners and some of the matches that you guys, with whatever tag partner you had, that you guys really lit up the AWA with Wayne Bloom and Mike Enos, who are known as the Destruction Crew. You want to talk about, mentioned the veteran wrestlers that were in the locker room. These guys were some young, strong, hungry, ready-to-go opponents for you. It was almost like the perfect blend as far as the AWA went at that time, because the matches you guys had, with Paul and with DJ, were amazing against the Crew.
Yeah, they were, and that was very beneficial for me. Again, I go back to the time before I broke into the business. I'm playing ball at South Carolina, or I'm preparing to go to camp with an NFL team, and I'm watching the AWA on ESPN, and I see Pat Tanaka and Paul Diamond, and Diamond Dallas Page is their manager. It's bad company. And, I got to know those guys. I got to know Pat very well, and of course, Paul very well, and when they put Paul and I together, and Paul and I and myself and Wayne Bloom and Mike Ennis, we were all young guys, but still you can learn things from young guys as well, just as you can the old seasoned grizzled veterans. And working so much with Ennis and Bloom, they were actually good at helping me relax in a ring. Now, keep in mind, I come from a football background. Up until this point, everything I had ever done in my life, and I started playing football in the fourth or fifth grade. So, and I played baseball a couple of years, but I had been involved in athletics all my life. And everything I'd been involved with was a shoot. I mean, it was a big-time shoot. Mm-hmm. There was going to be a winner and a loser, predicated upon how well you manhandle a guy in front of you. As an offensive lineman, every play when the ball was snapped, it was my job to manhandle, to physically beat a guy in front of me, his job to try to do the same to me. Now, I'm stepping into a wrestling ring, and I realize that this is a work, but at the same time, I've still got that shoot mentality drilled in the back of my head. And, this is, even though we're out here working together, I mean, this is still somewhat of a physical confrontation. And I was as tight as a drum. I mean, you couldn't have driven a nail up my butt if you'd have had a 10-pound hammer. And those guys helped me to get in a ring and relax. Bloom and Enos did. Take it easy. Enjoy this. We're having fun. We know what's going to happen. We know how this thing's going to end. And just enjoy the process of getting there. And they helped me get that mindset in my head that, hey, man, I'm not out here to beat this guy up or to beat that guy up or to physically try to be an imposing, intimidating figure over him, but we're actually in here working together. This is somewhat of a dance, and let's hook up and let's dance our way through this thing. Let's have fun doing it, and let's try to entertain these people that have paid their hard-earned money to be here tonight. So I learned from those guys as well, even though they didn't have a lot more in-ring experience than I did. I guess my point being is you can take something from just about everybody that you cross paths with. And I was able to take that from Enos and Bloom. Get in the ring, relax, and have a good time, you know?
Mm-hmm. And, I also want to mention that with DJ Peterson, there was a guy that was around the territory circuit in the 80s. And unfortunately, a motorcycle accident kind of cut his life short. But while he was in the business, he was the guy that just seemed like he was almost, there was just one more step that he could have taken to kind of push himself up and over. But, I mean, what a solid in-ring guy that he was during his run.
He was. DJ was very solid in. And again, there were things that he was able to teach me. I spent a good bit of time on the road with DJ, and I'll never forget the last trip we took together. Of course, we were the last AWA Tag Team Champions. you know, that the company ever had. They went out of business shortly thereafter. But I vividly remember our last trip together, and I never would have guessed that it would have been the last time I would have ever seen DJ alive. He was such a gracious guy, just a good guy, just a down-to-earth guy, no type of pretense about him, just a hard-working guy. And it was just so tragic and sad that his life ended way too early before he really ever had a chance to become what I think he could have become in that business.
He was just on to something. You just had a feeling that there was something that was going to happen with him, but unfortunately, he didn't get to be able to see that through. I want to talk about the AWA Team Challenge Series. Now, that was one of the last big flickers for the AWA coming out of Super Clash 3. You happened to be a part. This was supposed to be this revolutionary concept. At least that was what they were selling us upon on AWA television, that captains and team concept. Now, you were in the midst of this Team Challenge series, and you had a chance to be taking part in some of the gimmicks involved. But what can you remember of the Team Challenge series? I think it was teams captained by Baron Von Raschke. There's another guy you probably had spent a little bit of time chatting under his learning tree, Sergeant Slaughter and Larry Zbysko. What do you remember of this? I mean, this was just at a time where the AWA was just couldn't find footing at the end. And it was a nice idea and concept, but it just didn't quite take off for a myriad of things, a variety of things.
No, and it was just another one of the many things they were trying to do. I would put it in the same bag with other things they were trying to do. At that point in time, I mean, there was, believe me, I was on TV 5 days a week on ESPN, but I had no illusions about this company. You know, it was what it was. It was a company struggling, a company on life support, and they were reaching for any and everything they could that they felt like may put some life back into it. There was the Team Challenge Series concept. We even, I don't know whose idea it was, it had to have been Vern's to do it, but we even went into a TV studio on a couple of occasions and filmed for TV with no fans in the building.
What was that like, Del? I mean, I've seen pictures of that, and I've seen little bit of clips, and it was this infamous pink room or whatever room it was. What was that like? Because you guys had to emote that, like, you guys are working with a crowd. Was it just something that Vern was going to spice up with extra noises and other additions to it? I mean, to be able to have this big high concept idea, but then to be at that point where you had to relegate it to a TV studio. I mean, God, what was that like? Just that feeling. I mean, I knew the writing was on the wall, but it had to have been just kind of like, wow, we're just keeping it here.
Well, it just reeked of desperation, and we knew it was. It was desperate, but these men, and I don't blame them. You put yourself in Vern's shoes. This was once a big-time power broker in the world of pro wrestling. I mean, his company, the success it had, all the talent that came through there and that went on to other places, and now he is, I mean, literally fighting to stay on TV and to keep this company afloat and keep it relevant. And it's just not working. And it was brutal having to get into a ring with nobody in the building. It was just dead silence other than the guys in the ring grunting, the sound of the mat bouncing around and taking bumps. But outside of that, it was probably the most difficult thing I've ever done, trying to really get into a match with no crowd there, no ability to interact, no ability to really hear if they're buying what you're doing, if they're not buying what you're doing. It was extremely difficult. But again, along with the Team Challenge Series, it was just things they were trying to do. Another really one that's just, I cringe when I think about it, is they had Enos and I in a football match. Now, we were two guys at that point in time, we're so young in our career, we really didn't have a clue how to work a regular match. Now you're going to put us in the ring with helmets on and shoulder pads on and a football in the middle of the ring. And they were just trying any and everything they could. I can't tell you how many conversations I had with Greg. That this big deal with Viacom was right around the corner. Man, they're going to drop millions of dollars into this company. They're going to make us meaningful again. They're going to give us new life and new blood. And it's just right around the corner, just right around the corner. And you talk, Greg, and months later, well, man, there was a snag coming up, but we think we've got that worked out. They're bringing other investors in. And I mean, we're talking about tens of millions of dollars. And all of that may have been going on behind the scenes, but it never came to fruition, and it never happened. So it was a desperate group of men just trying to hang on and doing everything they could to do that.
That just had to have been just a stinger thing to the morale. I mean, you know, you had guys that were there that kind of knew the way of the world with pro wrestling and kind of could see the trend. But there was also younger guys that, you know, they were, there's probably some that probably didn't think that, you know, where the next move was going to be, while others had had their future secured, like Enos and Bloom and yourself in your story. But there just had to be just that uncertainty bubbled over in that locker room and the morale. I mean, gosh, it must have just been like that dead, like you said, like a dead man walking sort of situation with that company. But yet trying to put on some entertainment nonetheless. So it's like you got to turn that frown upside down, sort of showbiz stuff. But in the midst of it, you can just see the levels of desperation.
Yeah, you could. And it was on display every time we went to do TV. And of course, the few house shows, spot shows we were on, attendance wasn't very good. So it was very clear and very obvious that this thing was dying on the vine. But, you know, again, I was a young guy. I was looking for an opportunity. And at least at that time, it had me on TV 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm. With the ESPN deal. And, you know, we're getting a little bit closer to wrapping things up. We have a few more minutes left in the program. And I want to just kind of, I'm going to mention a couple of names, you know, play a little name association, if that's okay with you, sir. When we talk about the AWA Team Challenge, and this is a guy that I've watched on television on the local AWA program that we received out of Winnipeg, Manitoba, because we live close to the border where I grew up. One of the guys, he one time got a break with Ventura, but this is a guy that became a cult favorite, and he was probably one of the more over guys in the AWA at the end, and they kind of played up the role in the team challenge. But, you know, when I think of Jake the Milkman Milliman, I just think about the AWA team challenge and how it became kind of farcical at the end with him and the turkey match and then the battle royal. But that was one of those things where he was just a guy that wasn't the main event, became such a cult sensation.
Yeah. I can't help it, and I know in some ways you'll go, wow, that's just not even a good comparison. But in some ways, I think it is, in some minor ways. Every time I would think of Jake, I would think of the Grateful Dead. I mean, you know, it's just like, it's not what the mainstream's buying, and it's not what the majority of the people out there are buying. But by golly, there are some people out there that just love this cat, and they love him. And it just worked. I mean, you know, he was just this short and a great guy, but not the, you know, the most pleasant thing to the eye to look at. And not that I was either, but, you know, it was just, it just worked in that sense that for some people, he did become a very popular figure.
The Milkman indeed. And you mentioned Brad Rangins, and Brad, you know, a lot of people, you know, the casual fan would have just think, well, Brad Rangins, he did a little bit here, a little bit there. He was never hugely over in whatever company, but if people would just kind of look beneath the surface for Brad Rangins, they would realize not only was he just big in the amateur wrestling world, but he had such a hand in not only helping out with pro wrestlers as well. I mean, this was a guy that did some training even for a younger developing Brock Lesnar and countless others that, you know, we probably don't know much about, but yet this was a guy that I think deserves a lot of credit for a lot of behind the scenes stuff, because he was a really, really good unsung trainer, and especially towards the end of those days with the AWA and even beyond into the 90s. And you had a chance to not only work with him, but also to room up with him for a while. Let's talk about Brad Rangins. This is a guy that needs a little bit of the spotlight here.
No, I totally agree. Just as solid as you can get in the ring, his mechanics. I mean, everything about him, you couldn't see through anything Brad did. He just had a great mind for the business. Just solid. He was great at helping teach and train. And, you know, he went over and worked for Inoki quite a bit in New Japan. And he had a building there out behind his house. Again, it was in sort of a barn-like structure. or a ring out behind his house. It was, again, sort of like mules in a barn-like structure. But my buddy and I that from the Citadel that I went up to Minneapolis with, Brad rented out the basement of his house. It was turned into like an apartment, an efficiency apartment. There were two girls, Jackie and Ruth, that had lived there forever and had rented from Brad. But prior to myself and my buddy getting there, the Nasty Boys had lived there and had trained with Brad. So Brad, you know, influenced them, worked with them, helped them. Prior to the Nasty Boys, Jannetty and Shawn Michaels had lived there and rented from Brad and spent time in Brad's ring and worked with Brad and trained with Brad. So Brad, definitely, just a very, very, very solid worker. Great. And being able to relate that and teach that to quite a few guys. So Brad, you're absolutely right. Brad deserves a lot more credit and spotlight than he's ever got.
Yeah, 100% on that. And a guy that was kind of merely starting his career when the AWA was starting to end its run, and a gentleman that moved on to WCW to great heights and to a degree as an honor role in the WWE, a guy that helped kind of in his own way, you know, reshape the landscape of professional wrestling and head towards its own reinvention in the mid to late 1990s. This was a guy that started off, they always make the story of him selling meat off a truck and working side jobs and eventually getting his way into Vern's inner circle. I want to talk about, and it was towards the end of the run, and he was coming up, Eric Bischoff. I mean, this was a guy that was involved and was the voice along with Lee Marshall for the Team Challenge series and some of the AWA programming on ESPN in those later years.
Yeah, Eric, you know, did our TV, you know, would do a lot of the ringside interviews after matches for the TV shows, sort of the voice of the AWA, like you said, along with Lee Marshall. And I'll tell you, it was that relationship that I built with Eric while in the AWA that led to me going to work for WCW. Eric, at this point in time, years down the road, is now in charge at WCW and running the show. They're doing things there by committee. They're booking by committee with that committee, including Greg Gagne, who once employed Bischoff. Now it's vice versa. Greg's working for Eric. But it was that relationship that I had in the AWA with Eric that led him to picking up the phone and calling me several years later and said, "Hey, man, I want you to come into Atlanta. Sit down, let's talk and see if we can't put something together. I want you to come to work for me." And so I went over to Atlanta and met with Eric for several hours one afternoon and walked out of there with a 3-year contract. So he was very, very instrumental in that WCW door opening for me, he and Greg together. Mm-hmm. And it all started with that relationship in the AWA.
Yeah, and it's a guy that just, you know, had such a drive and such a vision that what he wanted, to project in the pro wrestling business, and a guy that, you know, who would have thought, you know, when you were watching and working with Eric behind the scenes that it would only be a short matter of time for which he had such a prominent role and became such a big, big thing and a big part of Ted Turner's pro wrestling company.
He sure did. His fingerprints are all over the business.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. And as we get going today, we're just kind of doing the AWA edition of Wrestling Memories with you, Del. And there's always other times down the road if you have the time here in the next few months or whatever ahead that I'd like to talk to you about your time with Global and your international stuff over in Japan. But I felt that, you know, since we are up here in northwestern Minnesota, that I really wanted to talk with you about and share with you and you share with us, the audience, your memories of working with the AWA. And as we wrap up, is there some things you would like to kind of talk about, you know, that we didn't touch base on to kind of wrap up our AWA talk this week on Wrestling Memories, Mr. Wilkes?
Well, you know, there's a lot that could be said about the AWA and my time there and the people that I met and got to work with and some that we didn't even mention today and maybe another day we can. Guys like truly one of the funniest human beings I've ever met in my life and quite a character, John Nord, Scott Norton. Scott and I worked there at the same time as well on a few occasions in the AWA. Working up there in Minneapolis and staying in Minneapolis for the months that I lived there. Also, you know, that's where I met Mike and Joe, the Road Warriors, which later became very good friends, and guys I worked with in the WWF. And it just had quite an impact on my career, and not only on my career, but my life. And I'll tell you, it is amazing, and I'm being completely, I'm not blowing, you know, any smoke about this. It's amazing how powerful the AWA was at one time. I've been in the automobile industry since I retired from wrestling. Well, not ever since I retired, but for the last 15 years. I've been in the car business, and I can't tell you how many clients I've had over the years that when you get to talking and trying to build some rapport with a client, they found out what I did in my previous career. I found out where they're from, where they grew up. And they grew up in Wisconsin, or they grew up in the Dakotas, or they grew up in Minnesota. And I mentioned the AWA. And it's amazing that even some of these folks are now older people. Before the AWA TV show and that wrestling, they can just bring off the memories and the names and the characters and the wrestlers. It's unreal. So even though it was in the last days when I was there and took a part of it, or was a part of it, it was very instrumental in my career. I got to work for what at one time was a fabulous, powerful company. And it introduced me to a lot of great people and a lot of good friends that I still have to this day. I'm still in contact with Greg and talk to Greg several times a year, Greg Gagne. So it's always been a part of my life, and it will always be that way.
I want to thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. Again, we got to work something out to have you on, and we can even go extra innings if we can work out our both of our schedules, get the logistics right, because I think we've only scratched the surface on this, and we can get into more AWA talk. Oh, man, we could talk forever about global. It is a pleasure and a privilege to have you on the program, sir. And again, the door is always open for you to come on in. We could talk on Facebook and set something up sometime down the line, but for now, it has been a great honor.
Well, thank you very much. Likewise, it has for me as well. Thank you for having me, and I look forward to talking to you again in the future.
For the Trooper, Del Wilkes, I'm Glenn Broggett. This has been Wrestling Memories.